The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Empowerment Hour. Today, you're going to hear about why our 21st century slave society can't last. Who are the slaves? Andrew Nikeforuk of the Thai will give us that. From Dr. Stuart Bramhall, drug companies killing kids for profit, the myth of childhood bipolar disorder, drug companies are deliberately breaking the law, the diagnostic criteria for bipolar and how it's a fraud. So you're going to have a real primer on these issues. Plus, from Tom Englehart, are we living in a post-legal America? From Tom's Dispatch. This commentary will deal with the idea that if you and I break the law, if we jaywalk, if we're too noisy in Central Park, we can get ticketed. If we steal something, we can go to jail. But that's us. All the hierarchical individuals, especially in government, and especially our government, are not held accountable for anything they do. So we're going to examine, as part of our commentary and feedback issue system, living in post-legal America. Those are the issues we're going to be addressing. Of course, we always start with the latest on health and nutrition and healing. Asthma in kids is very common. It's absolutely epidemic. The reason that I believe that we have it is for two reasons. First, because the enormous number of vaccines that children are given destroy their immune systems before the immune system has had a chance to naturally evolve what we call natural immunity. And there is no end in sight on how many more of these scheduled vaccines pharmaceutical companies will give. But after all, look at it from their point of view, and it makes a great deal of sense. It's completely logical. The logic is perfect. Pharmaceutical companies have managed through the World Health Organization, the CDC, the FDA, and the U.S. Public Health Service, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Those are the official umbrella organizations to determine our need for vaccines. Using no quality science whatsoever, using industry-sponsored clinical trials that do not show that a vaccine will protect a given child, that do not prove that a herd immunization works, and in fact, studies actually show just the opposite, that the vaccines that are given to us do not create lifelong immunity, but once you have chickenpox, mumps, measles, you're immune for life. They're terrified of this idea of natural immunity. Therefore, they want to create a synthetic immunity. Hence, we don't call it vaccination, we call it immunization. I challenge them. I challenge the immunologist. I've read their work, all of their papers on this. Show me the study that proves that a given child or a given adult will be protected and not harmed from any given vaccine. They cannot. That science does not exist. As someone who teaches graduate science, as a scientist, as a qualified person, and as a journalist, I meticulously study the literature. I even bring in other researchers, other scholars who research the literature. None of us can find anything except an entire myth built around vaccinations. So when you're giving kids vaccines, and you don't have to provide science, but rather belief, and you become then the official agency, and then you identify the manufacturers so they cannot be sued, no matter how many injuries or deaths occur, and then you buy the vaccines for different agencies at very elevated prices, So the manufacturer reaps billions of dollars in profits, all with the myth that we're going to be protected. So, kids end up with asthma. Also, on top of that, they end up with inner ear infections, one of the most common reasons children go to a pediatrician. Look at dairy. Look at sugar. Take dairy sugar out of a child's diet and watch how few ear infections they have. If a child has asthma, there's easy ways using natural techniques to clean up the child's biochemistry and to have a relaxation of the muscles and tissues in the chest area and in the lungs so that the child can breathe normally. We've shown that repeatedly. Vitamin D associated with asthma improvement in children, and being able to have multiple nutrients like fresh vegetable juices in children. But children aren't drinking fresh vegetable juices. They're drinking colas, and that's not good. Colas have caffeine, bad for a child. Also has sugar, artificial flavors, artificial colors. And those, some are known to cause cancer. So that's why kids have asthma. This study simply says that they're getting a lot of unneeded antibiotics. Quote, one out of six children with asthma receives an antibiotic they didn't need, according to new study findings. And that's over 1 million children. And that was published in the peer-reviewed journal Pediatrics. But here's what's wrong with that. Asthma is not due to a bacterial infection. Why then give any antibiotic under any conditions? Because it means not only will it not do any good, but it will actually do harm, because the child's intestinal tract will have all the good bacteria destroyed by the antibiotic. Antibiotics are not selective. They'll kill all bacteria. The trouble is, bad bacteria are much more resilient and can adapt, and hence we have antibiotic-resistant bacteria today. So nowhere in this article do I see a criticism of the doctors prescribing antibiotics for the cold, which is clearly flu, and that's about 33 million antibiotics a year. That means that each one of those physicians was practicing bad medicine. Why aren't they reprimanded? Why aren't they called out? But they're not. So we have bad medicine being practiced with no consequence. We have children getting antibiotics, which can cause sickness and antibiotic resistance to bacteria, and nothing's done about it. That's why it's important you be aware of the downside of American medicine. Now, on a good level here, if you have high blood pressure and you want to lower it, celery. That's right. A new research published in Cancer Prevention Research has found a chemical, a natural chemical, that you've heard me discuss called apigenin, A-P-I-G-E-N-I-N. And it can help stop certain breast cancer tumors from multiplying and growing. In fact, let's just go to India. Ayurvedic remedies. Celery seed is commonly used as a diet. And since fluid retention aggravates high blood pressure and other problems such as gout and arthritis and PMS and congestive heart failure, if you took celery seed in a beverage and then juice celery juice, you could help yourself with high blood pressure, the common cold, cough, sinus congestion, respiratory infections, bronchitis, laryngitis, and preventing breast cancer. All that by juicing. Now, what is the most common juice I've always suggested on this radio program? Always. Celery, cucumber, and apple combined. Now you know why. Celery is very high in calcium, magnesium, and potassium, but also compounds called thiolides. Now, these are known to lower blood pressure and promote healthy circulatory system. You can eat it raw, that's good, but it's better to juice it. You get more of it. The celery leaves, the seeds, and the roots can all be eaten. And the seeds are particularly rich in iron and have anti-inflammatory and antispasmodic properties. So when I'm detoxifying someone, which is constant, I mean, every single night I'm on the phone counseling people. If I'm traveling, I call them. And these are terminally ill people. They only get to see me if they have a letter from their doctor saying that there's nothing else medicine can do. And the reason for that is, if I have someone with maybe just some fatigue and someone who's got 3 months to live, and I only have so much time, I want to put my energy in trying to help the person who's at death's door. I have other protocols and other ways of helping people with minor conditions, but the detox is crucial to everyone. I don't care who I see or what their condition is. I always have them detoxing and always have them juicing. And no matter what condition they have, the juicing helps all conditions because it helps the overall body. And it also is a natural chelator. It gets rid of a lot of mercury, cadmium, and lead, and aluminum that have been stored in the tissue and that are disruptive to the body's metabolism. So something is real simple. Now, here's the other side of that. Here's major studies published in peer-reviewed journals that show that celery and a compound specific to celery, apigenin, can help stop certain breast cancer cells. But where those of us who understand functional foods, meaning a food that functions in the body to heal, prevent, or treat a disease, and the whole idea of functional medicine or functional healing, in functional medicine it's just a physician that is offering that, but in functional healing it's anyone who has a background that can help guide a person in choices they make, like a dietitian, nutritionist, a holistic chiropractic, etc. We know the power of foods. The FDA is on a rip right now trying to suppress all information from being released anywhere on functionality of foods. The FDA is a corrupt organization. It should be completely abolished. All of the people held responsible for acts against society who have done so should be brought to justice because they have allowed drugs such as Vioxx that killed 60,000 Americans and caused 120,000 heart attacks and strokes to exist. They knew the danger. Their own internal physician, Dr. David Graham, who I filmed, so stated that, and they attacked Dr. Graham and allowed this to come out. It's a completely corrupt organization at every level. I believe all those people who've allowed drugs that have killed and injured should be held accountable. But again, as you'll hear from the post-legal America, if you're working in a governmental agency, if you're a bureaucrat, you can do anything to anyone and get away with it. That's why we actually have to fear our government today, something Democrats haven't quite got yet. Their intellectual conceit doesn't allow them to acknowledge, gee whiz, you mean there might be some imbalance in power? Yes, there's a great deal of imbalance in power. And those of us who are looking at the actual issues don't want an agency that is controlled by lobbyists that represents special interest groups like pharmaceutical companies, having the power to offer us deadly drugs and then no recourse. That's a serious issue. But you haven't broadcast it. You haven't talked about it on Rachel Maddow. It's as if it doesn't exist. So, very good reason for a lot of people to challenge the arrogance, the conceit, the spoiled brat attitude of so many people in the liberal community who refuse to acknowledge that there's a problem with vaccines. I'd rather talk to a brick wall than try to move a mind that refused to look honestly and openly at an issue. And that's why we're in the problem we're in. It's not just the radicalized Republicans and conservatives. The liberals and the Democrats are equally responsible for the mess we're in today. Ask your Democrat friends when was the last time they had a juice. Yeah. How about a colonic? Bike to work week and reduce heart disease by half. This is a nice story, and it's from the British Medical Journal. And let me quote this from Medical News Today. According to the British Medical Association, cycling just 20 miles a week can reduce the risk of coronary heart disease by 50%. A major study of 10,000 civil servants suggests that those who cycled 20 miles over the period of a week were half as likely to suffer heart disease as their non-cycling colleagues. And that's important. So if you could reduce your risk by 50%, why not? Cycling's good for you on all levels. Strengthens the musculature, releases endorphins, helps speed up detoxification of the body, expands the lungs. It's all good. We just don't do very much cycling in the United States. We should. And finally, for those who are interested in what we can do to prevent childhood cancers, this is from the International Journal of Environment and Health, as reported in Science Daily. Quote, chlorine and childhood cancer is the article. Now, a significant positive association, quote, has been found between the risk of childhood leukemia and levels of chlorine-containing chemicals in the atmosphere. And, where's one way we get a lot of chlorine? How about in a hot shower? Unless, of course, you have a protective shower filter. So the longer your hot water comes out and those nice steams come up, you're getting chlorine gas. So just remember, that's the major source of that. And put a filter on, and that will help you. Oh, do you remember about, I think it was a month ago, I was doing a show on the environment, and at that time I suggested that for those who still believe that global warming is not man-made or is not real, and we really don't have to worry about the glaciers melting, and I said, we better pay attention, because the glaciers are melting. And they're melting so fast that what we thought would take 100 years could take 5 years. This is this morning, Science Daily. Quote, melting glaciers may affect the ocean currents. A team of scientists in the University of Sheffield and Bangor University have used a computer climate model to show how fresh water entering the ocean at the end of the Ice Age, 140,000 years ago, affected parts of the ocean currents that control climate. Then it went on to talk about how our glaciers are melting today. And the researchers found that fresh water entering the ocean from melting ice sheets can weaken the climate control part of the large-scale ocean circulation, with dramatic climate change as a consequence. And the team argues that it is not only the volume of fresh water being released from the melting ice sheets, which is important, but also the state of the fresh water. Icebergs act to reduce the ocean circulation less than meltwater, but the effects of icebergs last for much longer periods of time. So when enough fresh water goes into the ocean from Greenland, from Antarctica, from glaciers, that can affect that circuit. You've all heard of the Gulf Stream, where warm water is brought up, circles around up past Ireland, and comes back down again. That's what keeps the temperature comfortable in the Mediterranean and in England. If there's so much water that enters that's cold, it can close down that circulation or alter it. If that happens, immediately the temperature drops in Europe by as much as 10 degrees. That could have devastating effects, and that's where we're at this moment. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Hey, you! Come out here on the floor. Let's rock some more. Come out of here on the floor. Honey, let's rock some more, yeah. Now when you get out here, don't you have no fear. Put your hands on your hip and let your backbone slip and work out.
Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to our issue part of the program. This is where each and every day, either I write a commentary or I present someone else's commentary or some combination, but it's because I believe that we do not have enough critical thinking that is being shared with the American public. If anything, I see the same mindset, the same conversation, the same dialogue every single day. And I believe that that's not helping us, either on the left or the right radio. So instead, let us take a look at a different way of approaching problems and see what the solutions are. This is from Tom Engelhart, and it's entitled, Are We Living in a Post-Legal America? From Tom's dispatch, I'll quote, Is the Libyan war legal? Was bin Laden's killing legal? Is it legal for the President of the United States to target an American citizen for assassination, which he has the right to do now? Were those enhanced interrogation techniques legal? These are all questions raised in recent weeks. Each seems to call out for debate, for answers. Now, here is the issue. It isn't enough to explain that we should be discussing this. If in a country theoretically organized under the rule of law, wrongdoers are never brought to justice and nobody is held accountable for possibly serious crimes, then you don't have to be a constitutional law professor to know that its citizens actually exist in a post-legal state. If so, is it legal is the wrong question to be asking, even if we have yet to discover the right one. Of course, when it comes to arranged potential Bush-era crimes, the use of torture, the running of offshore black sites, the extraordinary rendition of terror suspects to lands where they would be tortured, illegal domestic spying on Americans, wiretapping on Americans, the launching of wars of aggression, it's hardly news that no one of the slightest significance has ever been brought to justice. On taking office, President Obama offered a clear formula for dealing with this issue. He insisted that America, quote, should look forward, not backwards, and then turn the page on the whole period, and then set his Justice Department to work on other matters. But honestly, did anyone anywhere ever doubt that a no-Bush-era official would be brought to trial here for such potential crimes? Everyone knows that in the United States, if you're a robber and you're caught breaking the law or breaking into someone's house, you'll be brought to trial. But if you're caught breaking into someone else's country, you'll be free to take to the lecture circuit, write your memoirs, or become a university professor. Of all these so-called debates over legality in the Bush and Obama years, the torture debate was perhaps the most interesting, in some ways the most realistic. After 9/11, the Bush administration quickly turned to a crew of hand-picked Justice Department lawyers to create the necessary rationale for what its officials most wanted to do. In their quaint phrase, take the gloves off. And those lawyers responded with a set of pseudo-legalisms that put various methods of information extraction beyond the powers of the Geneva Convention, the UN Convention Against Torture, signed by President Ronald Reagan and ratified by the Senate, and domestic anti-torture legislation, including the War Crimes Act of 1996, passed by a Republican Congress. In the process, they created infamously pretzeled new definitions for acts previously accepted as torture. Among other things, they essentially left the definition of whether an act was torture or not to the torturer. That is, to what he believed he was doing at the time. So if a person was torturing someone but didn't believe he was torturing him, then it wasn't torture. Well, by extension, could you not put someone against the wall in a firing squad and shoot them, but you really didn't intend to kill them? But you did kill them. You did torture them. So isn't that illegal? No, not according to the people at the Justice Department, because you didn't believe you were really doing that. That's the pretzel part. And in the process, acts that had historically been considered torture became enhanced interrogation techniques. An example would be waterboarding, which had once been bluntly known as the water torture, and whose perpetrators had in the past been successfully prosecuted in American military and civilian courts. And such techniques were signed off on after first reportedly being demonstrated in the White House to an array of top officials, including the Vice President, the National Security Advisor, the Attorney General, and Secretary of State. I didn't know about this, Did you know about this? Nobody knew about this. That they actually did a demonstration of waterboarding in the White House? Well, that's a news story. In the United States, the very issue of legality fell almost instantly away. Newspapers rapidly replaced the word torture when applied to what American interrogators did with the term enhanced interrogation techniques, which was widely accepted as less controversial and more objective. At the same time, the issue of legality of such techniques was superseded by a fierce national debate over their efficacy. It has lasted to this day and returned with a bang with the bin Laden killing. Nothing better illustrates the nature of our post-legal society. Anti-torture laws were on the books in this country. If legality had truly mattered, it would have been beside the point whether the torture was an effective way to produce actionable intelligence and so prepare the way for the killing of bin Laden. By analogy, it's perfectly reasonable to argue that robbing banks can be successful and profitable as a way to make a living. But who would agree that a successful bank robber hadn't committed an act as worthy of prosecution as an unsuccessful one caught on the spot? Efficacy wouldn't matter in a society whose central value was the rule of law. So if you got away successfully, it was okay. If you got caught, that's a different matter. In a post-legal society in which the ultimate value espoused is the safety and protection of national security, what does it mean? As if to make the point, the Supreme Court recently offered a post-legal ruling for our moment. It declined to review a lower court ruling that blocked a case in which five men who had experienced extraordinary rendition, that's a fancy globalized version of kidnapping, had been turned over to torturing regimes elsewhere by the CIA, tried to get their day in court. No such luck. The Obama administration claimed, as had the Bush administration before it, that simply bringing a case to court would imperil national security, that is, state secrets, and they won. And as Ben Weisner, the American Civil Liberties Union lawyer, had argued the case, summed up the matters, quote, to date, every victim of the Bush administration's torture regime has been denied his day in court. Well, let's put it another way. Every CIA torturer, all those involved in acts of rendition, and all the officials who okayed such acts, as well as the lawyers who put their stamp of approval on them, are free to continue their lives untouched. Recently, the Obama administration even went to court to prevent a lawyer from a former CIA officer convicted in Italy in the kidnapping of a radical Muslim cleric from privately sharing classified information about the case with a federal district judge. Yes, Virginia, elsewhere in the world, a few Americans have been tried in absentia for Bush-era crimes. In response, wrote Scott Shane of the New York Times, the judge, quote, pronounced herself literally speechless. The realities of our moment are simply enough. Other than abusers too low level to matter to our national security state, no one in the CIA, and certainly no one of any sort, is going to be prosecuted for any crimes whatsoever committed at any time in the Bush era or this presidency or any future presidency. They are above the law. But not whistleblowers. President Obama has a fetish, a passion, an anger burning in his belly to go after anyone in government who decides that something is wrong, that there are crimes being committed, and to tell the world about it. Then they throw the full force of the Espionage Act against that person. And we have multiple cases of that. And then he goes on to talk about all those people who are now being prosecuted vigorously by our Justice Department, not because they helped the enemy, but because they wanted to show the world what was wrong with these national security agencies. Your thoughts? That's our issue. A country without law. That's the United States. If you're in power. But a country of excessive laws and excessive bureaucrats and excessive people wanting to get involved in your life at every level, if you're not a powerful power player. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. I'd like to hear what you have to say. And while you're thinking about what to say, let's go into our studio in New York City and say hello to Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. We've been emailed an article This is by a person called Rania Karlik. It says it's called For Sale, The Desperate States of America. And basically, it talks about how states are, in order to raise money for their budgets, they are privatizing our public utilities and things. For example, in Chicago, they've gone and sold off the parking meters to Morgan Stanley, and they get huge returns in profit, revenue, in the future because of it. For example, I'll just read it for you. At least $11.6 billion will be paid to Morgan Stanley in the next 75 years. For what was the sale was $1.15 billion originally from Chicago, sold them to Morgan Stanley, and there's all sorts of examples here. But from your, in your opinion, what are the long-term dangers of privatizing like this? Because to a layperson, they might think, "Oh, this sounds like a nice idea. You know, lots of money's coming into the states. It sounds good." Mm-hmm. But there clearly must be long-term dangers because, you know, well.
Have you ever heard of the American Horace Greeley?
No.
Journalist back about 100 years ago. He said the darkest hour of any man's life is when he sits down to plan how to get money without earning it. Right now, none of the Wall Street firms are actually earning money. They go to the Federal Reserve. They can ask for any amount they want, hundreds of billions. They're given that money for free. If they have any bad debts, if someone screwed up and made a bad debt, okay, no problem. They give that bad debt, that junk, that garbage, to the Federal Reserve. Imagine that you're having a bad day, Elizabeth, and you want a loan. So you go into the bank, and they say, "What's your collateral?" And you hand them a brown bag, and you say, "This is my defecation from this morning. I decided to put it in the bag to give you instead of flushing the toilet. And it's worth, I guess, $10 million. That's the amount of loan I want." Do you think you would get your $10 million for your bag of crap?
No.
No, you wouldn't, would you?
No.
All right. But the Federal Reserve takes crap every day, the worst possible defective pieces of garbage for collateral, cleans it, destroys it, it's never heard of again, and gives clean money to the company. That person then goes out and they go to a state and they say, okay, right now the United States has about $125 billion with all 50 states, actually it's 48 states, that actually have deficits. And then, by the way, that's only 1 year our war debt bill. But instead of charging every American per family member, in other words, you get a bill saying this is our war bill, this is your war tax. And if we gave every American a tax at the beginning of the year for what all of our war would cost, then they get another bill. The second bill that comes in the mail is a spy bill. So to spy on you, to fly planes over so we can listen to conversations and we can drive vans up the street and see in people's homes, we can read every email, all of which, by the way, is done. This is not controversial. This is done. And now they're going to add drones. You know those drone planes? Quote, spy drones becoming pervasive inside the United States from Global Research. Quote, unmanned aircraft have proved their usefulness and reliability in the war zones in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now the pressure's on to allow them in the skies over the United States. The Federal Aviation Administration has been asked to issue flying rights for a range of pilotless planes to carry out civilian and law enforcement functions. And this is from the Washington Post. Gee whiz, but here's the interesting part. They've been doing this for some time. There are all kinds of drones spying on us every day over the United States. Were you aware of that?
No.
No. Okay, well, neither were the Democrats, evidently, because they don't seem to mind how much the government invades into our space and civil rights, human rights, constitutional rights, habeas corpus, the right of due process. None of those exist today in the United States when you go up against the government. They can say anything they want and spy on you. Now you got all this money going out. What if you got a bill showing how much the 16 different spy agencies, $80 billion, and then a little summary of what they do with that money? How many Americans do you think would really be happy to know that most of those are doing nothing to protect us? They're all based upon insider contacts with former generals and admirals and legislators and senators and House members and presidents of the United States like Bill Clinton, who is now worth close to $200 million. He and his foundation over $500 million, all because of opening doors and making money for a lot of people. Do you think they'd pay those bills?
No.
Would you pay a war bill, knowing, and then put on the war bill? Here's a photo gallery of all the civilians, all the children killed this year in our war. How would you like to know that you're paying to kill innocent civilians?
Yeah.
And how about the munitions makers, showing how much money the munitions makers, who had the big lobbyists, are making off these wars? So as long as these wars go forward, they make profit. Now look at the other side of that. The hedge fund people come in, sleaze bags they are. The equity partnerships, you don't. If you look under low life, you see grinning hedge fund and equity partnership dealers, because these people are really cannibals. They only care about how much money they can make. They have no conscience about how they make it. And I include George Soros in there, the darling of the left, as well as the Koch brothers. These are like two scorpions in a cocktail glass. All right? There's not one good and one bad. They're all bad.
Right.
Because they don't live in the real world. They're not responsible for their actions. They're not responsible for what happens with how they make their money. Soros shorts the peso. 100 million people who use the peso now can't afford food. But as long as you give to a left foundation, you're forgiven. So the hypocrisy of the left is as palpable as the right. All right? Now you get all this money. So money's not the issue, because in effect, you're using debt as an asset. So now you go into a town and you say, okay, look, we want, in Chicago, we're going to take over all your meters. Chicago needs the money. Okay, how much can you give us? We'll give you $1.1 billion. Did you actually earn that money? And they just look at each other and laugh. We don't earn money. We steal it. We're banks. What are you, an idiot? Did your IQ drop below zero? Banks don't earn anything. They are purely, primarily, predatory. They are all inside, and they're getting their money from the Federal Reserve, or they're getting their money off, let's say, forcing the price of oil up, even though they'll never take a gallon, and they're violating the Commodity Trading Act. They're dealing in derivatives. Anyhow, or selling people worthless items. But they've got their money, unlimited amounts. So now they own all the parking, and now they can put in more meters. And instead of having you be able to not use a meter at night, which most don't, they can make a meter 24 hours a day. So you can't park unless... Well, that increased the revenue stream tremendously. But now they want the prisons. Well, gee whiz, all the prison systems in the United States are now going privatized. Who's buying them? Who has the money to give a state $500 million? These groups. Where did they get their money? Did they save it up? No. They didn't save anything. It's debt. Are they responsible for it? No. Because when they lost it before... They were given it all back again, $13 trillion. I see. So they cannot lose. They're too big, and they're politically connected, and they're all corrupt, and they're all immoral, but they're darlings of the left and right because they fund the foundations, they're smart to give money, then they hire scientists, and they hire academics, and they hire legislators, so they own everything. This is fascism. What is fascism, Elizabeth? Fascism is where you have major corporate interests, business interests, own and control politicians to dictate what is in the interest of that corporate interest. That's America today. We are a fascist state.
Right.
So if you are going to make profit off prisons, you got to have prisoners, right?
Mm-hmm.
What happens if you have some progressive people believe that nonviolent offenders shouldn't be in prison, that we should decriminalize drugs? Think that's going to go?
Oh, yeah, no.
No. Oh, my God, no. No, you got to find more ways to put more people in prison for longer. And you can do that by listening to Sean Hannity and those people who loved. My God, the lack of reason here is mind-numbing. if you privatize the prisons, it becomes a profit stream. You can only make a profit per prisoner. So when you control how the prisoner is abused, oh, did I say abused? Yes. Then you're not there to rehabilitate the prisoners. That could be done if you actually chose to rehabilitate them. You want to punish them because they're bad. They did something bad, right? So we want to make sure if you're in jail, you're bad. But if you're out of jail, you're good. So if you're in Congress causing wars to be funded and people to die who shouldn't, you're good. And you steal a candy bar, you're bad. It's just amazing. But when you privatize a prison, you can only do that if you know that you have the control over the legislative process to increase the amount of incarcerations by more criminals or more people being defined as criminals. For example, debtor's prison. Do you know we now have a debtor's prison in the United States?
No. Oh.
No. See, in England, you stop your debtor's prison. In the United States, we didn't. We now, if you can't pay a bill, you can go to jail. Well, that makes a lot of sense. I'm so poor I can't pay my debt, so put me where I absolutely can't pay my debt. Boy, that's only a conservative could come up with that idea, right?
Yeah.
Let's make it impossible for you to pay your debt, but then how are you going to get out of jail? Well, you can't get out of jail till you pay your debt because you're not a good citizen. This is what we're dealing with privatization. Using other people's money to take over national and state and city resources. They want to sell off all of Utah. Do you know that 90% of Utah is owned by the federal government?
Right.
So now they want to sell off all that land. Well, who's going to buy the land? Who would buy land in Utah?
Yes, right.
Huh? People who want to exploit it for its natural resources.
Oh, just terrible. I mean, this is just absolutely hell.
This is what we've been dealing with. But unfortunately, the Democrats and Republicans who are both part of this and their supporters in the media on MSNBC and the goomballs and the people on the right and the left, this is how they keep us distracted from ever thinking deeply on any subject or coming up with an understanding of it. The Boris Report. You've heard of Representative Republican Paul Ryan, who wants to get rid of Social Security and Medicare.
Yeah.
Here's the latest quote. Presenting what he called a revolutionary plan to slash the nation's mountain of debt, Representative Paul Ryan today proposed eliminating Social Security program in its entirety and replacing with Groupons. Quote, instead of waiting each month for a check from Social Security, America's elderly will receive valuable Groupons for everything they need, from ramen noodles to cat food to caskets, Ryan said in an interview with Fox News, adding that Groupons would also help provide elders medical care. The congressman illustrated his point by holding up a Groupon offering 30% off on open-heart surgery in Cincinnati. Moving on from Social Security, Ryan also proposed replacing Medicare with a new program in which seniors are shot at by predator drones. Additionally, Mr. Ryan said in his new budget, so-called friends with benefits. You know what those are, Elizabeth?
I've heard of them.
Well, if Ryan says that if in his new budget, friends with benefits would lose their benefits. Quote, if they're really friends, they should be satisfied if the evening ends with a voucher. Speaker of the House John Boehner appeared alongside Representative Ryan, offering these words of praise for the Wisconsin congressman. Quote, preachers like Harold Camping go around predicting the end of the world, but it's guys like Paul Ryan who do the hard work of making it happen. Let's hold on a moment there. I think I answered that one question. Let's say hello to Ken from New York City. Hi, Ken. You're on the air. Oh, Ken's off. Rob from Long Island. Rob, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay, you can hear me. I want to thank you for what you do, for being one of the few independent thinkers, a humanist, skeptic, and who shares his thinking and his doing with the rest of us. I guess I was going to just make comment on the commentary about not having law. You could describe it in other ways. You could say that there's two legal systems, one for the ruling class and one for the rest of us. Just as well as saying there is none, because there is. the machinery of punitive justice is there, and it's made use of every day, and we have more people in prisons than any other country in the world. Okay, I could go on and on, but let me give somebody else a chance.
I appreciate very much, and you are correct. That's why I say that if you steal a candy bar, you can go to jail, but if you, let's say, lie and extort money by, like Halliburton, by cleaning a bag of GI laundry, one duffel bag, for $100 a week, and instead of what would have been a quarter or 50 cents, you're allowed to get away with it. So I believe that until such time that we recognize that we should not have two legal systems, one for everyone else and one for those in power.
If I could go on now, just for a second, I mean, this all exists because of control of people's minds. We think of the news as being lies or spun, but actually it's the sitcoms, it's the commentators on everything under the sun that shape the virtual world that people live in, the mythology of wanting to get an education to earn a living instead of learning how to live, going along with everything. I'll stop again. Thank you.
Rob, thank you very much. I appreciate your comments. Back into our studio, and if you would like to continue and share your thoughts, please do so. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We have Elizabeth. Elizabeth has got some she has questions that have been raised or comments from people in the audience. And I believe that Jason has just joined her in studio, and I'll be back in studio live in New York City tomorrow as well, having finished now later today all the filming on this particular project. Hi, Jason. Jason's not in studio. All right, we'll go over to Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Here's a similar question. Why is it that so many different groups won't work together? For example, why aren't the Greens able to work with constitutionalists? And why can't the Libertarians work with the Conservatives, please?
It has to do with how people perceive their reality. This is, as much as anything, it's based upon ignorance. It was Alfred North Whitehead who said, not ignorance, but ignorance of ignorance is the death of knowledge. So when a person believes completely, a true believer, that theirs is the truth and no other truth should supersede it, no other truth should share the same space, then they ally themselves with people who share that common belief. And hence then you end up with true believers, no matter what it is. It could be in a religion, it could be in a political system, it could be in a social system. So when you sit down with people, I believe that the most important thing to do is first ask, are you capable of going to neutral and setting your beliefs and ego outside the door? If you can do that, then we can just look at a problem and then ask each person, how would you go about solving the problem? So then if you're open to having people's ideas, how they see a problem, then you start to formulate from each person. What if someone talks for 10 minutes, but there's a little gem of an idea, then you take that gem and you put that up on the board. So at the end of this discussion, you have a lot of different ideas from different individuals who have different beliefs, but there's no one dominant. It's not like this is it and this is what we're going to do. It's working together. And once you show that people can work together on a given theme, but you have to have a theme. Because right now what you have is you have at least 20 different groups that represent a total of 45% of the entire American population. Incredibly powerful if they organize, but they're not organized because it's challenging for them to surrender the idea that someone else might have a say-so that has value. So at one level, you have to deal at the humanistic and spiritual level. If you can't have spiritual and humanistic individuals sitting at the table and saying, let's look at what really works, let's not make who said it or what their background is what drives this dialogue, but what works, what's which solutions, then you're opening it for everyone to have an input, and that's what's missing. You don't have the spiritual and the body politic at all today. You have religious, but that's a complete joke compared to what is really spiritual. And so we need spiritual men and women coming together who are not ideologues, but want ideas. Then you create coalitions of positive change. That's what a progressive is.
Right. Thank
you. Let's say hello to Ken from New York City. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hi, Gary. How are you today?
Doing great. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. I love your show. And hi, Elizabeth. I just wanted to say something real quick about the war on terror in general, and I wanted to mention something that we're leaving out a lot of times. The hypocrisy of the left, who place their doxy above their survival. If we pay attention, I don't know if you've been paying attention to what's going on in Britain, which is now being called Britainstan, where the Muslim birth rate is 10 to 1 and the number one baby name is Mohammed. BBC reports this. According to the government's own studies, the white child in Britain is now marginalized in his own country. And the Islamification, if you go on, you can see the cops being chased for their lives on YouTube by mobs of Muslims screaming Allah Akbar. The police are running for their lives. And I'd like to discuss that in the greater context of the of what's going on in the West. I find it alarming that we're not concerned about the coming of the Day of Islam in Europe, which is now being called Eurabia, Swedenstan, Britainstan, Hollandstan. And what are we going to do about it? Because they see our tolerance as weakness and stupidity and apathy, and they're using it against us, Gary. And I think it's something that we're not being racist to point it out. We're generally alarmed for, you know, what's going to come in 20 years.
Okay. Ken, I would share, I understand your anger, but I would like for you please to pull back for a moment. It is not Islamic views that are of concern, because then I would have to say, well, look at all the right-wing, radicalized, rapturous, Republicans who believe that if we don't give all of our values over to an interpretation of the Bible as how we should be directing our laws, how they should be written, how they should be reinterpreted. And just imagine if in the United States, those who are the most powerful religious fundamentalists, from Pat Robinson on, what if they could rewrite the Constitution and they could rewrite the laws by which we live by? Well, then we would have an ultimate fascist state. We would have a theocracy. Well, we don't, because we do have a separation of those two. Yet they are allowed an opportunity to give their points of view, and we're allowed an opportunity to rebut them. But we shouldn't overreact to it. And it is not Islam, in my opinion, that is the problem. Rather, it is how we have treated the Islamic people around the world, how we have treated the Muslim population. Let me give you one example. We had an opportunity when Obama took office and he went to each of those countries, including Egypt, to say we will no longer give financial or military support at all to any government. And we will create sanctions to any government that imprisons its people, that has no freedom of the press, no freedom of the rights of women to carry on their lives as they deem best for them. And we didn't. We did just the opposite. We mouthed platitudes about freedom, but we did not do anything. To the contrary, we continued to give Egypt $3 billion. We continued to support Israel. Without the Palestinians, we continued to support all the 22 Arab League nations. We are still supporting Bahrain. We're still supporting Saudi Arabia. And it's one of the most repressive, racist, homophobic, lacking in complete spirituality. And it has one of the most radical forms of Islam, Wahhabism. But most people within the Islamic movement, most people within the larger religious movement reject radical Islam. The 100 million people are mainly young people who are going to the streets and sacrificing their lives in these countries to protest. They're not protesting because they want to see a caliphate. They're not protesting because they want to see Sharia law. They're not protesting because they want women to be treated even more severe or held to strict standards. They're there because they don't have jobs, they don't have food, they can't feed their family, they have educations, they're much smarter than any group that preceded them in understanding the world, and therefore they're bringing not just a moderate view, but a more progressive view. And they're not buying any of the rhetoric of Obama. So they're in contempt They don't hate Americans, but they're in contempt of this administration for being utterly hypocritical in everything it's done in the past and everything it's doing now. Even today, we're supporting the military dictatorships or the military ruling elite in each country, even if we have to throw the ruler, the emirate, or whoever it may be, or a king, under the bus, because we still want to have the military contracts. We still want to do 20 and 30 and 50 and $60 billion with a single country like Saudi Arabia in arms shipments. That's all it is about. So creating a false red flag fear so that you can then begin to say the problem is not our administration and its policies and its lack of support of real and authentic democracy and real and authentic freedom and real and authentic freedoms, but rather it's continuing business as usual because of the geopolitical interests we have. Don't get distracted by some of the hate mongers. Ken, I just ask you to keep yourself neutral and look at all the facts. Thank you very much. Let's say hello to Jason in studio. Hi, Jason.
I'm sorry, Jason's not here.
Get some crazy glue and just glue
Jason
to a chair.
Here he is. Jason's right. Here. Okay. Here he comes. So.
And we're going to be transitioning in a moment here. Hi, Jason.
Sorry about that, Gary. I apologize. I was just doing some work.
All right. And what's up, Jason?
Oh, nothing. I was just got some stuff over the weekend that I wanted to go over with you. I want to let our listeners know that we have not only the best progressive minds working here, but they want to thank them for getting us over 162,000 downloads this weekend. All week, we've been having great people listening to our shows, which include Michael Rupert, Dr. Helen Caldicott, Dr. Cheryl Selman, Glenn Ford, Stephen Ledman, Mitchell J. Raven. That's just a small sampling of hosts who constantly share articles and talk to our listeners to try and help everyone get empowered. We have all types of walks of life listening and working on PRN. We do no personal tax. We have no advertisement, just a great forum to share dynamic ideas. And we still are getting more downloads with no advertisement than NPR. And your downloads are up there right now with about Rush Limbaugh. So I just wanted to tell everyone to thank them, tell them to keep coming, because we do have the best progressive minds working here.
Well, thank you, Jason. And people should know that we are working quietly behind the scenes with progressives all over the world. And what makes a person progressive? You can be conservative and progressive. A lot of people, a lot of business people are progressives and still conservative financially. I'm very conservative financially. I don't believe in spending money I don't have. I don't believe in incurring debt and trying to make it somehow through alchemy an asset. And yet we have liberals who are progressives, who have broken away from the Clinton greed Democrat base and the Obama base, who don't want that, you know, to feel entitled to a seat at that very gilded table in the new robber barons. These are people who look at the problems and say, what are you doing to actually protect our environment? What are you doing to help our children? What are you doing to keep our schools and open and get better curriculum and get rid of the bureaucracies? What are you doing to make the bureaucracies we do need accountable and get rid of the fat in them? What are you doing to get rid of these wars and stand up for human rights? Those are progressive liberals. So we have progressives are people who seek positive solutions and are not ideologues and are willing to work cooperatively with other people to go forward. And there's a lot of those people. So when you just told me the number, 160,000 people over the weekend downloaded the shows, that's a phenomenal amount of people. Just that's not listening live. That's not listening live over the Internet. That's not listening live from a land-based station. That's just listening by downloading a program because people want real change. And how are you going to create a third party? How are you going to have someone, and not someone, how are you going to have referendums put on all the different ballots around the country to get changes unless you have a progressive movement? We've never had a progressive third party. We have a few progressives in Congress. Dennis Kucinich is one, and Ron Paul's one. And not everything they share would I agree with, but they're really standing up for people, and they have a lot of common sense. They have a lot in common, actually. But the vast majority, Bernie Sanders is one, but the vast majority are not progressive. The vast majority have sold out. If you look at what they produced, they had all the means possible to protect us, and they took away all of our protections, from the Glass-Steagall Act to now the Clean Air Act. They're doing nothing to protect our environment. They're doing nothing to address of this. Oh, by the way, one last good news before we end our show. I got an email this morning from a man named Richard, who I know, who said he is willing, with a group he knows, to come up with the money to buy or have built the 550 surge protectors that would go in front of the large generators to help with this solar storm that's coming in the next 12 to 18 months. And that's good. Again, that's a solution. That's someone seeking to make a problem less of an impact in a negative way upon us. That's more than our whole government is doing, because they're locked in this rigidified, almost a death throes. But they don't see it. They're like a diabetic eating 17 pounds of chocolate. They don't see that what they're eating may taste good, but it's going to kill them. So we have people who do not have the enlightenment, are not using their skills to help us. As a result, today as I speak, 270 million Americans are suffering who shouldn't. And more will suffer in the future because we do not have progressives in positions of power. Because the last thing we want is progressives. We don't want Rabbi Michael Lerner. We don't want Laszlo, Rupert Sheldrake. We would be terrified of a Chris Hedges if they actually had a chance to share their message to an American media and to an American public, because they're not compromisable. They tell the truth. Thank you very much for your listening. I'm Gary Knoll. And anything you need that you've missed, please download from ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Have a nice day.
1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.